every night. Yet I suspected he held out more than a small glimmer of hope that I would teach my friend a thing or two in the kitchen, in addition to kindly preparing dinner for us whenever I came to visit, which would be often, because I didn't foresee Carol coming to visit me back in Garden City. The apartment which was now the stage for my future was her past, and after their honeymoon, she would be spending most of her time in Saqqara with her husband as they hurried to finish his book on the Old Kingdom burial ground before the baby was due. But I no longer felt I was losing my best friend now that she was married. On the contrary, our lives were even more intimately interwoven than they had been when we were living next door to each other. My tourist visa had expired, but I wasn't flying back to Boston. I was remaining here in Egypt, where my best friend was, and where her baby would be born, my godchild, and where I also hoped to be married one day, but not merely in an office. The four of us dined outside with the Nile only a few feet away, lapping gently against the corniche, the flames of the candles on the table, protected by glass, burning brighter and brighter as the sun took its time setting that evening, lingering appreciatively in the rosy folds of Carol's dress and in her hair, a straight, shining gold like the river behind her. My friend had never looked so beautiful. She never stopped smiling. Even when she chewed, a smile lingered on her lips, her eyes on Simon, as he waxed eloquent on various subjects. I simply enjoyed watching him because of everything he wasn't saying, but which silently radiated from him. How happy he was. He had found and secured a priceless treasure for himself, which could not be measured or permanently labeled, because she was a living mystery. And as if that wasn't enough, she was carrying another unique treasure within her. Imhotep might have been the wisest man of his time, and his tomb might still be hidden somewhere not very far away beneath the desert sands, but I was sure the Egyptologist had completely forgotten all about it. After all, for a man who believed only in life, whatever that meant exactly, a baby's room had to be better than a tomb, at least for a while, before said baby began talking back and disobeying him. Then mummies lying silently in undiscovered sarcophagi would provide a welcome escape. The thought made me laugh, but no one asked me what I had laughed about, because we were all laughing. Any excuse would do. And if I needed further proof of Carol's contentment, it was the fact that she did not once pull out her camera. I imagined she felt as I did, that none of us would ever forget this evening. It was actually Steve who called our waitress over and, handing her his phone, asked her to take a picture of the newlyweds, then of all four of us. When he showed me the images later, I laughed at how wide Carol's eyes were, probably with shock that she had forgotten all about photographing one of the most important days of her life. But all too soon, it was time for Carol and Simon to head back to their new apartment. They were departing for Alexandria first thing in the morning, and I wouldn't see her again for over a week. I felt a surprisingly sharp stab of sadness as we hugged, almost clung to each other for a long, nostalgic moment, fighting the inexorable current of time and circumstances pulling us apart, even though we knew it was also helping keep us together. Yet there was also no getting around the truth that something always had to die in order for something new to be born. But even as my best friend disappeared into the night, I felt in those moments that nothing was lost. Not really. Not ever. Steve took my hand, and we began walking along the corniche. For a time, I felt us both enjoying being silent after talking so much for so long. But inevitably my thoughts, obeying the deepest currents of my heart, went back to Jesus and my vivid dream from last night in which I kissed the cross. I wonder what Jesus wrote in the dust in that passage at the beginning of John 8, I said. John mentions twice how Jesus stooped down to write in the dust with his finger. But why would John even include that detail in his account if it had nothing to do with what was going on?
I really don't know, Mary.
He sounded pleased I had broken our silence with such a question.
The Gospels are eyewitness accounts. So, look at it this way. When detectives ask people to give their account of a crime they are all witnesses to, or of a person who is a suspect in an investigation, they instruct them to recount every little thing they can remember about the event and the suspect, even what might appear to be inconsequential details.
Oh, yes, that makes sense. John was there, and later he wrote down what happened just like he remembered it. He had his eyes on Jesus the whole time. Everyone was watching Jesus to see what he'd say. Maybe no one else cared, but because John loved him, he was intensely curious what Jesus was writing. So later, he remembered this little detail that everyone else, even if they'd noticed it in the first place, would probably have forgotten.
Exactly. Eyewitness accounts are never identical because none of us see the world in precisely the same way. The events eyewitnesses describe are primarily the same, but there are always a few unique discrepancies, and the same is true of the Gospels, which makes them even more credible.
I never knew any of this. I don't think even my parents, who are both attorneys and deal with eyewitness accounts all the time, realize that's what the Gospels are, not made-up stories. Steve, do you think it's wrong to open up the Gospels at some random spot when I feel I really need Jesus to speak to me? Every time I've done that so far, what I read is completely relevant to what I'm going through.
Why would it be wrong, as long as that's not the only way you read the Gospels?
Oh, no, of course not. I'm almost finished with Matthew.
Well, please don't rush. Whenever I read the Word of God, it speaks to me and opens me up to a better understanding of my experiences. I'll always be reading the Gospels. By the way, the Gospels are part of the ancient literary genre of lives, what we call biographies. There are numerous independent accounts of Jesus that come from sources written in Aramaic and can be dated to within just a year or two of his life. Historical sources like that are incredibly unusual for an ancient figure.
We walked in silence for a minute before I thought out loud, wouldn't it be fascinating to ask and pray one night when we became lucid to be shown what Jesus wrote in the dust that day?
It would, but you'd have to be more specific. You wouldn't understand Aramaic or even Latin or Greek, I assume.
I shook my head.
Then you'd have to request to see what Jesus wrote in the dust with his finger in English so you could read it.
I was very glad Steve accompanied me up to the Garden City apartment, because it felt strange enough turning the key in the lock and walking in knowing Carol was gone and would not be coming back, at least not to live, and honestly, probably not even for a visit, because in 5 months Matthew was supposedly returning and I would also be moving out. It was a relief when Steve closed the door behind him, because I had been afraid he might just kiss me goodnight and leave. Yet his continued presence also made me a little nervous and self-conscious, because there was technically nothing stopping us from doing whatever we wanted. I said, "I'll pour us both some water."
"Please."
He accompanied me into the kitchen, where we drank as thirstily as if we'd been lost in the desert for days. Port before dinner and red wine with dinner, followed by a long walk on the Corniche, then an almost equally long black-and-white taxicab ride back, added up to a major thirst. When we returned to the living room, I observed, "The apartment feels so empty without Carol here." Steve began patting his chest as if looking for something in one of his shirt pockets.
"I don't feel like a ghost."
Laughing, I punched him playfully in the arm, the way I had seen Carol do to Simon a few times, but much more gently. Pulling me down onto the couch beside him, Steve raised his left arm, and I slipped beneath it so we could assume our usual cozy cuddle.
"You're never alone, Mary."
I know, but I also knew that the minute he left, I would feel very alone, painfully so.
Think about what you want for breakfast tomorrow morning, because I'll be here bright and early to pick you up in my new Jeep.
Really? I separated myself from him slightly so I could see his face. So you found somewhere to park it?
No, I'm staying at Simon's place while he's on honeymoon. And surprise, I have the whole week off. Sure, I have to answer important calls and emails, but he'll also be taking care of business while he's lying on the beach.
You have the whole week off?
Mary, when you smile like that, I feel like I'm already in paradise.
Grabbing his face with both hands as I pulled myself up onto his lap, facing him, I kissed him passionately, hungrily, savoring his lips, his tongue, the very slightly rough texture of a day's stubble just barely discernible beneath his shaved cheeks, the soft, silky depths of his hair, everything about him I could touch and taste. His hands resting lightly on my hips, he allowed me to get my fill of him, responding to my kiss in a measured way that enabled me to draw out the pleasure of feasting on him by seeking what he was holding back. Until, deliciously sated for the time being, I fell against him and rested my head on his right shoulder for a moment before sitting up again. Caressing my hair away from my face, he said,
"I'm going to say goodnight now, Mary. It's been a long day."
"Yes, wonderful, but long."
"I have some ideas about what we can do this week. We'll talk about it over breakfast."
"Great," I exclaimed, then shocked myself by adding, "But first I want to go to confession." His right hand moved to the cross hanging around my neck, his gift to me, and the way he caressed the delicate white gold crucifix between his thumb and forefinger made me think of a magic lamp, except it was infinitely more than that. In the cross, the three wishes of legend had already been granted as the Holy Trinity, offering us life and love everlasting. Gazing into my eyes, Steve said,
"Mary, my lady, your wish is my command."
And raising the cross to my lips, he watched me kiss it. End of Book 2. In Lucid Dreams and Spiritual Warfare. Next in the series, Light and Breath.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.